this evening we have a little light literature here. But I gave you a break. I only brought the first volume. This work, which was published, the first volume, in 1677, and the second volume a few years later, may be described as the fountainhead of our literature of Kabbalism. The author was a very profound scholar, Christian Knorr, Baron von Rosenroth. He was a university professor and not Jewish, but Christian. Yet with this background, he became profoundly interested in what has been called the secret doctrine in Israel. He was certainly a man born before his time, for during the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, the very subject of the Kabbalah was not only not frequently mentioned among Jewish people, but almost never outside of a small group of very scholarly rabbis. Even in our present century, the subject is a highly controversial one. I've had the distinction and pleasure of upsetting a considerable part of an Orthodox Jewish congregation by reference to this subject. They rushed immediately to the rabbi, and then trouble broke. However, in the last 20 years, the entire attitude of the scholarly world has changed. Perhaps our increasing interest in psychology had something to do with it. For in Kabbalism, we had another one of those archetypal patterns of human ideas which are concerning us more and more. Perhaps also the rise of Zionism had something to do with it. In any event, at the present time, that learned, infallible source of information, the Encyclopedia Britannica, observes that all 19th century and earlier appraisals of Kabbalism must be entirely re-evaluated. By this we mean, and they mean, that the negative position taken earlier is no longer held to be sound. At the present time, at least two groups, one in Germany and one in Israel, are working to restore the neglected fragments of Kabbalistic literature. Manuscripts are being sought out, collected, placed at the disposal of scholars, and the modern tendency is to view the Kabbalah much as the Jewish people have viewed the Dead Sea Scrolls, as a relic of the past that may be of immediate value in solving basic problems, not only of Jewish sociology, but of the relationships between the Jewish and non-Jewish worlds. Von Rosenroth was aware of this. He sensed it long ago. He knew that this very mysterious subject was deep, was important, but like most of the scholars of his time, he was unable to cope with it in a complete manner. Individuals who knew much less than he did have therefore risen as his critics, complaining about minor errors of translation and worrying about the possible alternative meanings of carefully worded phrases. But in spite of this picking process, which has so long attempted to discredit honest scholarship, his volumes remain as the great monument, for they signify the first real effort to use Kabbalism to bridge the interval between Jewish and non-Jewish thinking. Up to the time of von Rosenroth, practically all of the Kabbalistic literature was in Jewish only. And the non-Jewish European society had no particular interest in this literature. In fact, they were really afraid of it. It became involved in a great many rather unsavory legends and was finally regarded by Orthodox non-Jewish people as perhaps some form of Satanism endangering the morality of the virtuous. But now that these older clouds have passed from the horizon, we are interested in trying to understand one of the most confusing, perplexing, and austere of all concepts of life. I suppose the only parallel work in obscurity is the Chinese volume, the I Ching, or Classic of Changes. And in many respects, the two works are similar. Both deal with extremely obscure metaphysical concepts. Both have a tremendous traditional antiquity, and both have survived to this time, much to the wonder and even consternation of scholars. Within the last 15 or 20 years, however, the I Ching has become of interest far outside the boundaries of China. And the interest of the Jungian psychologists in the Chinese Classic of Changes may possibly indicate that in the future, men of similar minds will begin to explore the recondite side of the Kabbalah. We really know very little about the antiquity of this work. We know that it was first circulated in Europe about the year 1305. At that time, the principal exponent was Rabbi Moses of Leon. And for a long time, it was assumed that he had fabricated the great Kabbalistic book, the Sefer HaZohar, or the Book of the Splendors. It was just taken for granted that he had fabricated and manufactured the entire work. More recently, however, it became obvious that if he did, he was perhaps the most extraordinary mind in history. It became easier to assume that this man, who though brilliant was not exceptional, had secured his information elsewhere. It just became too large a subject to be encompassed within the life and ability of one person. Rabbi Moses was a very busy man. His life was fairly well known. There was not much possibility that a work of the magnitude of the Zohar could have been produced by him without others knowing about the processes. He would certainly have had to call upon rare reference material and things of that nature. And this was not apparently the direction of his life at all. So perhaps it would be wiser to assume that his own idea, his own statement at the time, was reasonably valid. Namely, that the work had come into his possession in manuscript form as part of the unwritten or unpublished, we'll say, legacy of Israel. In other words, that it was a work long secretly known, passed in rare copy from one great scholar to another, and that it finally came to his conviction that it should be brought together and made available to the world. To explain the origin of the work, Rabbi Moses ben Leon, therefore, took the attitude, or held forth the belief, that is more or less contained within the text itself, that the original author was a Rabbi Simeon ben Yochai, a man who wrote the work or compiled it under inspiration about the year 161 A.D. during the reign of the Roman Caesar Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. This Rabbi Simeon was a mystic. To escape Roman persecution, he went into the wilderness and lived in a cave. And here for many years, he was supposed to have received mystical experiences, forms of illumination. The prophets of old came to him.
He received instruction from the angelic hosts that are referred to in the Pentateuch. As a result of this great length of time in isolation in this cave, he gradually wrote down or transcribed this mystic doctrine. However, of course, Rabbi Simeon did not himself claim that he invented the idea. He did not invent the Kabbalah. Nor is it actually demonstrable that he was the first to write on the subject in ancient times. Actually, I think we will have to assume that the Kabbalah more or less accumulated. And all of this accumulation did not take place within the body of ancient Jewry itself. The moment we begin to investigate the subject, we come upon a number of rather interesting possibilities. The date 161 A.D. may be comparatively correct for an important revelation by compilation of certain doctrines that were available in the Near East at that time. The actual structure of the Kabbalah shows that it is profoundly indebted to Gnosticism, the sect that was flourishing at that time in North Africa and in parts of Syria, a sect which has come again into prominence in recent years from the discovery of the great Gnostic library at Chenobaskin in central Egypt. The Gnostics taught a doctrine of emanations as a means of reconciling the Creator as an abstract principle, God, and the creation as a concrete structure. The problem of bridging between deity in its universal and mystical sense and the formal universe. This problem was one of the great problems of Gnosticism, and it is also one of the essential elements in the great Kabbalistic system. Also at this time, we must remember that Mahayana Buddhism was rising in India, perhaps had already risen. And this conveys another important element, which perhaps had been generally neglected in the Near East, and therefore was felt to be necessary in the unfoldment of Jewish religion. The Kabbalah, for example, deals with a basic problem of the difference between transcendence and immanence. Transcendence in this sense means the transcendence of God. Jewish religion had, orthodoxly speaking, created a God above and superior to the world. This deity rested eternally above the world and the planets and beyond the grasp and contact of living things. Seated on its eternal throne, it was an absolute despot over creation. This distant, all-powerful God, the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac, was scarcely the concept of deity most useful to the Jewish people during the Roman captivity. The Jewish empire kingdom was gone. These people had received a tremendous spiritual disaster into themselves. This disaster undermined faith. It undermined the old way of life. It seemed to cry out that God had forgotten Israel. It seemed as though there was too much of punishment and not enough of forgiveness in the divine nature. This God of powers and glories, this El Shaddad, the strong, was not the type of deity that could comfort a sick, forlorn, and miserable scattered people. Something nearer, something more immediate to their lives was very necessary to them. There is really no doubt in the world that this was also one of the mainsprings of Christianity, which arose in the same general area and also came to a people weary, and disillusioned and tired. This sense of Christian immediacy certainly profoundly affected the religions of the West, especially through the Christology of St. Paul. So it is quite possible that Mahayana Buddhism, which had this tremendous emphasis upon the immediacy of spiritual authority, that it was not something infinitely remote, but something infinitely available. The deity was not far away always, not looking down from an omnipotence upon a tired world, but that in some way deity was here. Deity was therefore imminent. It was available at any moment to be reached, to be understood in some measure, to bestow its consolation upon the suffering heart and the broken pride and the tortured soul. This Mahayana Buddhism accomplished in connection with classical Buddhism, which was the rather austere doctrine that Gautama gave the world. This doctrine of Gautama was also too transcendent for the average Hindu to live by. He needed this softening, gentle touch. He needed this doctrine of the bodhisattvas, the wonderful beings who with their great ears listened forever to the sorrows of men, who were always available through prayer, and who interceded with the universe as consolers of human sorrow. The church fell somewhat into this same problem, and from it, instinctively patterning upon older peoples, Christianity developed its doctrine of saints and the doctrine of intercession, by which the individual, in his spiritual need, was able to bridge the interval between humanity and divine help. So we have in Kabbalism this arising among a people previously almost completely deficient in this particular attitude, almost entirely lost in a strange spiritual austerity, something perhaps suggestive of Brahmanism, something suggestive of the wonderful, deep, but incomprehensible wisdom of the universal power itself. Men could not live entirely, supported only by the belief that God was wise. They had to also experience the fact that God was good, that God was love, that God was ever-present help in time of trouble. It therefore would seem reasonable that during the difficult periods in Jewish history, a number of sects should arise, like the Gebers of Hebron, the Nazarites, and the Essenes, who were to emphasize this phase of the divine presence, that not only to the great scholar, the learned master of the Sanhedrin, would this spiritual presence of God be known, but also to just ordinary people who could reach deity in some inward experience of their own. While the old Jewish system did not emphasize such intercession, it was to a measure present, at least archetypally, in their beliefs. For the system of Jewish prophets is almost unique in the religious literature of the world. These men of the wilderness and in the desert, these comparatively uncouth persons who dared to rise up in the presence of kings and threaten the wrath of God upon the unbeliever or the disobedient, even as the prophet from the wilderness dared to stand up and accuse David the king. So there were these men of the wilderness who lived close to God and who seemed to speak with the authority of deity. And this group together were called the prophets. And the Old Testament contains a number of prophetic books attributed to them. And all these books imply that these prophets had in some way attained knowledge of the divine will, of the divine purpose, and were therefore empowered to warn the people of the wrath to come. At the same time, we find running through the Kabbalah interesting scientific elements. And most of these elements probably must be traced back to the Greek Pythagoreanism. It is sometimes held now that the Essene community at En Gedi by the Dead Sea was originally founded by Pythagoras. In any event, the Greek system certainly influenced both the Essene school and the Therapeutai of Egypt, another mystical Jewish community. The monadology of Pythagoras, his doctrine of number and numeration, certainly has become so associated with the Kabbalah that today many people popularly referring to numerology will call it Kabbalism. Certainly the Kabbalah did deal with a philosophic use of number to represent principles, to represent forces and powers, and to reduce universal processes to numerical equivalents. Also, the old idea of reading the meaning of names seems to have risen from this concept. For today, numerologists will take the letters of a person's name, and finding the numerical equivalent of these letters, will add them up, place them under the discipline of notoricon and gematria, as it is called in the Kabbalah, come to a sum number composed of the letters of a name, and then attempt to delineate or to variously analyze that person through the number of his name. Also, the ancient Hebrew belief that the days of man's life are numbered. Now, we have always interpreted that to mean that he could only live so long, but that these days might be numbered in some kind of a mathematical or magical manner has not generally occurred to the reader of Scripture. So in the numerical system of Pythagoras and other aspects of Greek philosophy, we find material which later, passing through a certain Judaistic interpretation, was embodied into the structure of their Kabbalah of numbers. Rabbi Akiba in the Sefer Yetzirah, which was the book of the numerations, also gives us valuable information as to the numerical equivalents of the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. So here we have another phase of the subject. In Kabbalah also, as it passed particularly down into those dark and mysterious years, which we know as the Middle Ages, certain elements of necromancy occurred. And to what degree this was essentially different from the demonism of Europe itself, which was passing through a psychological condition which seemed to make these metaphysical things a little too real. What the relationship was, we do not actually know. But we know that magic mingled with alchemy, that magic is to be found in many of the old Hermetic books, and that the various grimoires, or books of conjuration of spirits, all make use of Kabbalistic elements. Thus the signatures of angels and demons, and all of these mysterious rites by which spirits were invoked out of the misty deep of space, all these came finally to be called Kabbalism. Agrippa von Netzheim was one of those scholars, mystics, esotericists, who combined magic, hermetic arts, the Kabbalah, into a strange and mysterious compound, which caused him considerable religious difficulty before he got through with it. But at the same time, the policy was present. This is probably one of the reasons why, after we came out of the Dark Ages into a more modern point of view, that the Kabbalah was held in fear or disrepute. It was because it seemingly had been associated with demonology and witchcraft. It was also used and is still used in some parts of Europe and even in parts of Asia where Jewish communities exist for helping so-called possessed persons to get rid of evil spirits and things of that nature. All of these incrustations, however, actually belong to what might be termed the misunderstanding of the subject. The Jewish congregations in these dark periods were not much better informed than their Christian counterparts, and as a result, superstition was general. And out of this, these superstitious practices has come much of the bad reputation from which the subject has suffered. Let us assume then, for our purpose at this time, that Kabbalism really began not necessarily among the Jewish people at all, but certainly it arose in a period extending between the 6th century B.C. and the 4th century A.D. This millennia that lies in that span was in that time just about as cataclysmic as our modern world appears to us. New religious interpretations had risen in India and China and Persia. Great philosophers had come to Greece and Egypt. And the centers of culture at that time were moving rapidly in their spiritual understanding from a more or less archaic foundation to the very position which modern religion now occupies. For actually, religion as we know it in the world today has not greatly changed since this critical period between 600 B.C. and 400 A.D. During that time, almost all of the spiritual beliefs which we hold to be valid today were rising and developing and unfolding and integrating in the ancient world. Therefore, if we go to the great religions of the world, the only important religion that lies outside of this barrier and still survives is Islam. And Islam was certainly a byproduct of this system or situation, though it did not arise for another 150 years. But this whole period was one of man attempting a new attitude toward religion. And this attitude was the gradual shifting from this concept of transcendence to the concept of immanence. The old Brahmanic gods had very little interest in the doings of ordinary people. The ancient religious backgrounds of most other countries were formal, were distant. The great pantheons of deities lived their own lives upon some Olympian slope. They were the rulers of the world. Their vengeance could be often felt. Their help might be called upon by a community in trouble, or a city that was being assailed might raise prayers to its patron deity. But religion, as a quiet personal experience in the life of the private citizen, had not yet begun to exert its real force. Religion was almost completely a vast ceremonialism. It was man approaching a kind of celestial king who reigned in the same autocratic manner as his duly appointed representatives on earth. This was the time of the divine right of kings, and most of all, the divine right of God to be aloof, distant, to send thunderbolts, but seldom appear in person. This situation evidently came head-on into changes developing within the psychological integration of the human being himself. Man was growing. Man was unfolding attitudes and convictions. He was outgrowing in a very large way this belief, which even some people hold today, unfortunately, that the great spiritual mysteries of life are simply not for man. He must leave them alone. He mustn't even dare to explore them. That was one of the grievances that the medieval church held against the Kabbalists. They were audacious. They dared to examine the structure of the universe. They dared to attempt to lift the hem of the robe of the infinite and find out what was behind. This was heresy. This was something that was just not done. And the penalties were similar to those inflicted upon scientists or scholars or physicians or mathematicians who dared to speculate about matters held to be purely theological. The penalties were heavy in those days. But in spite of these penalties, men kept on. For the search for this imminence could not be blocked. Man gradually came to recognize that it was his right to ask questions, that it was his right to gather as they did the elders of the Zohar, and sitting down among themselves with their own associates, really, so to say, take the universe apart. That they had right to question, they had right to analyze, they had right to be unorthodox. And that was getting to be pretty dangerous. But they had also the discretion to clothe their researches in some kind of terminology that might appear to indicate a continual and, in fact, increasing devotion to religious principles. These various elements had to be brought into a pattern, or else, in all probabilities, these older teachers could not have survived. So the Kabbalah deals, first of all, with the idea that there is this universal principle, Ein, boundlessness. This boundlessness, however, as absolute deity, is absolutely inscrutable. The root, the mysterious source of all things, the most high of the most high, simply cannot be understood, cannot be known, cannot be grasped by human faculties. For it remains forever in its own aloofness. As Plotinus calls it, it is that which is forever alone. This no one really wished to criticize as a truth or a principle, because man was beginning to realize a little more about the universe in which he lived. Its immensities were unfolding to him through the rational philosophies of Plato and Aristotle. And man began to realize that this universe was suspended from some principle of principles, some universal mystery, and that this universal mystery just was not going to be solved very quickly. But this universal mystery abiding forever in space didn't seem to answer all the questions for the person who really was seeking to grow. To grow must result from the state of knowing. As man knows, he grows. The search for knowledge then became identical with the quest for life itself. And the thoughtful person felt that he had a right to understand all that he could understand, to discover all that could be discovered, to bring forth out of nature everything that nature had in it that could be made useful to man or made valuable to man in his own search for life and security. Out of this came one of the essential foundations, not only of Kabbalism, but of nearly all mysticism, and that was the sense of two interrelated existences harmonized through the law of analogy. In the Kabbalistic system, therefore, we have the great universal allness of things, called the makroprosopos, or the great face. This was the face of space itself. This was the face that man looked upon when he gazed out into the sky. And he had already begun to realize that he could not gaze far enough to look clearly into the features of that face, that it extended out into countless light aeons of distance, and that perhaps if he traveled forever at the speed of light, he might never come near enough to that face to fully comprehend its features. But this whole great sky mystery, bending over him as the god Nut in the Egyptian mythology, this great mystery was the face of the universal. He then devised a parallel concept, the microprosophos, or the little face. This little face was nature. For he came upon the concept of analogy, as given, presumably, in the Emerald Table of Hermes. Namely, that superiors and inferiors have a certain resemblance. The creation is the reflection of the Creator. Makroprosopos
looking down into the mystery of creation, beheld its own likeness reflected upon the surface of matter. The lesser world was fashioned in the image of the greater world. There were valid analogies between spiritual and material things. And nature, therefore, in some way had to be a key to God. For it became obvious that the inscrutable, the infinite, the one and only cause of all that exists, in some way does cause that which exists to exist. This existence must, therefore, be in harmony or according to the will of that which causes it, both the cause and the world it fashioned. Were so vast, so inscrutable, that it seemed incomprehensible to even the wisest man that anything could really distort this basic relationship. There was nothing that could cause creation as a whole to be untrue to or dissimilar to the Creator. Men might interfere in little things, but they could not interfere in the rising of the sun or the motion of the stars or the formation of elements or the growth of plants or the breeding of animals. These things were universal, and they had to some way bear witness to the universal purpose. To behold creation, therefore, was to behold the miniature reflection of the Creator. Those laws which exist in nature must be acceptable to the Creator, or they could not exist. Consequently, if we cannot know those laws which are spoken by the very mouth of Sophia, the embodiment of wisdom, we at least have the right and power to observe these laws operating around us. And in so doing, we should have the faith, and we should have the reason for that faith, by which we can say the laws of nature are also the laws of God. All visible processes are invisible processes made visible. And God is made visible in creation. Not in full and complete majesty, not in the greatest panoply of power, but certainly in a reasonable way, so that man does not just have to follow the revelations of other men. He doesn't have to depend entirely upon the authority of the elders. He does not need to build his entire code upon the so-called wisdom of the past. He has a living wisdom available to him. He has this wisdom which is the wonder and working of the world. So here we have the idea of the great face and its reflection. We have now the possibility of man exploring God through examining the universe. And not only this possibility, but to the Kabbalist and most other mystics, the valid right to do this, even though it might upset some of the best laid schemes of theological institutions. Furthermore, in this analogy between God and nature, there arose another mystery which seemed equally valid and equally important, and that was the mystery of the macrocosm and the microcosm. Now, the macrocosm was the great world with all its machinery, and the microcosm was the little world fashioned in the image of this greater world. And whether it was arrogance or insight, we may never know, but our ancestors came to the conclusion that the most complete working instrument by which the universal will can be made known is man himself. Man is the microcosm. Man is the little creature on biblical authority fashioned in the image of his God. For it is said that God made man in his own image. Male and female created he them. Now, if man was made in the image of God, and certainly the Kabbalah is based upon the Pentateuch, the Talmud, and the Mishnah, then it follows that by this same divine authority, by this same divine wisdom revealed by Moses and the prophets, man is in the likeness of his Creator. Thus, to see man, in a sense, is to see the Creator. perhaps not just man as a physical organism, but to become aware of the wonder of man, to be able to examine the various garments of man, to examine from the outer part to the inner part of man, is therefore to become aware of the law, of the divine purpose, and of the eternal wisdom. Even Maimonides, who was by no means a Kabbalist, in fact was one of the greatest of the early Jewish scholars who feared the Kabbalah, even Maimonides admitted that the nature of man himself was like the nature of the law, of which the outer and visible part, the Torah, corresponds to the body. In the invisible inner part, the Mishnah, corresponds to the soul, and the deepest and greatest spiritual mysteries of religion correspond to the spirit in man. Therefore, man, to a measure, is not only an embodiment of nature, but he is an embodiment of the scriptures, of the sacred writings, and all of the mysterious laws by which the universe is maintained. This was not entirely original, however, with the Jewish scholars. It already had been established in India by Hinduism. For the Vedic writings and the Puranas, the great literatures of India, both of them build strongly up in their cosmological sections by paralleling creative processes with the creative processes of man. Thus, to their thinking, the universe was generated as man is generated. The universe has its prenatal epoch as man does. The universe lives and grows like a man. It becomes aged, feeble, and ceases like a man. The universe, then, is patterned from a contemplation of the processes taking place in the biology and physiology of human life. This gave the Kabbalah a working foundation, namely that through the exploration of man, the study of all of his parts and members, man might come gradually to understand the universal principle for which he stands. Through the understanding of nature, man can understand the universal plan of which nature is an expression. And also through the contemplation of the sacred writings, the books, the scriptures of the world, which are also microcosms of this knowledge in another way, man can come to understand the Creator as this Creator as manifested in the mystical experiences of human beings. Altogether, then, the Kabbalah now provided a key. And the ancient rabbins of this school declared that the key can be turned 7 times in the lock. And in its 7 turnings gives man the 7 different series of analogies which can be set up by means of which it is possible to explore the Creator through his creation. Now, why should man want to know all this about the Creator? What was this strange hunger in man who wanted to know God? The mystic says it is perfectly natural that man should want to know his own source, that being a living thing and continually experiencing life, he should have a reasonable and natural desire to understand this life which he experiences. In searching for his Creator, therefore, he is only following the ancient admonition, "Man, know thyself." And it dawned gradually upon his consciousness that he could never know himself without knowing his God. Another reason why this knowledge of the Creator, or of the plan of the Creator, was so important, was because man had already experienced the fallibility of human opinions on these subjects. Very wise persons disagreed constantly. There were many faiths, many gods, many shrines, many creeds and sects, many schools and beliefs. And then, and even more now, man was confused by this complex of inconsistencies. It became gradually obvious to him that his own discrimination, that his own insight was not adequate. If when presented with 5 great, well-honored beliefs, he did not know with certainty which one to choose. He did not know how to weigh the arguments of one venerated teacher against the arguments of another who had arrived at a different conclusion. He therefore, as an individual, came to realize that there had to be some other way of knowing, There had to be a direct knowing. If there was not, there could be no end of uncertainty. It was also obvious that in this form of direct knowing, there was not a great deal of available information. No one seemed to know how to achieve it. If men had had it, if men had practiced it in the past, they would have come to agreement, but they did not. Consequently, it must be assumed that the average person, though he might be learned and considered wise by his associates, did not necessarily possess this insight, was not necessarily in a position to solve beyond debate or dispute any of the essential problems of life. The more man went on with this and his experiencing of it, the more he also came to another cabalistic conclusion that we face today. Whenever we get a grand panacea for something, when someone makes a pronouncement that is so universal that it seems to be impossible to contradict it, and we try to apply this, we suddenly discover that it is not applicable to everybody. We come to the realization that a doctrine which satisfies one will not satisfy another. And if we accomplish a great reform in the world, we find some people are pleased by it and some are not. There is no concept of heaven, for example, that man can devise that will be attractive to everyone who hopes to get there. And that which might be to us a blessed state would be to someone else a cursed condition. There is no uniformity, apparently, of the immediate need of man. His needs are so infinitely diversified. What he seems to need always is a certain comprehension beyond what he has. But when his neighbor tells him the answer to something, it is not this man's answer. It works for the neighbor, but it does not work for him. An answer given by a learned person is satisfactory to 10 and unsatisfactory to another 10. Consequently, there is a kind of individualism in human existence. Men are not all cast in exactly the same way. They cannot be held together by one common rule, at least none has yet been found that could hold them. They may even agree, for the most part, on the benevolence of certain concepts or ideas, but then they do not live them. There seems to be something by which the universal solution is not possible, that we cannot be all fed with the same food. We cannot always rejoice in the same experiences, although they may appear to be universally good. The only answer to this type of problem, to the Kabbalist, was that there must be some way in which each individual could tune into his own need, that whatever was next for that person must in some way be available to him. Finally, he is the only one who knows his need. He is the only one who can tell when it is truly satisfied. He is the only one who is able to engineer and implement his own next step forward. Thus, whatever this instruction is, it must be highly individual. It has to be almost as infinitely individual as individuality itself. There's only one possible answer to this mystery, namely that what man needs must be immediately available in himself, that his search for solution must always be in terms of himself, in terms of reaching into some root within his own nature, by which he will learn that which is next in the divine plan for the unfoldment of himself as he is, not as he would like to be, not as he wishes he was, not as he sometimes may think himself to be, but what he actually is, an estimate which he may not be able to arrive at even by his own best judgment. All this, then, does finally bear heavily upon that point in which the Kabbalah most closely came into conformity with the Gnosis, or the doctrine of the Gnostics, and that is this problem of emanation. Emanation is the only way in which the Gnostics, the Manichaeans, and several other early sects, including the Persians, the only way in which they could reconcile two opposites. It would seem that these opposites must emanate or cause to radiate from themselves conditions of themselves. that these conditions could meet, even if the essential natures themselves were too far separated. For example, from the sun comes constantly a radiance of light. And while the sun itself would probably be infinitely too splendid for man to approach and survive, yet this light from the sun is its emanation. And wherever this emanation goes, certain qualities of the sun go with it. And this emanation may extend countless light years into space, touching one planet in its orbit, as in the case of the Earth, and touching another, as in the case of Saturn. Now, the light of the sun on Saturn will be less than it is on Earth because it is further from the sun. But that light, in its own way, must sustain the life upon Saturn, or make it possible for this planet to be likewise fruitful. Consequently, by emanation, that which is further removed has a different destiny by this circumstance alone. That which receives this solar intensity less brilliantly must adjust to a different kind of life. This life may be just as good for all that we know, but it has to be different, because the proximity of the body itself to the source of light determines some of its qualities, determines to a certain degree its nature and substance. In the same way, the proximity of man to the source of his light, which is truth, has a great deal to do with his character. We find in the Kabbalah, then, this same concept that is everywhere present from the study of emanation, namely, that you have no principle in nature of either good or evil. You have only a principle of light and the absence of light, or the diminution of light. So we have the old philosophic definition that evil is not a thing in itself, but the least degree of good. It is a degree of good less than that which is present in some other creature. Therefore, we say that this lesser creature is bad in reference to this other creature, which is better. In nature, therefore, there is reality and its gradual diminution through emanation, until somewhere reality seemingly dies in illusion. But this illusion is not a principle. It is merely that which lies too far from the center of the light of truth. Ignorance is not a principle, but it is that condition in which the mind is far removed from the source of wisdom. But the mind may approach wisdom, and coming nearer, receive more of it, even if a planet moving toward the sun will become warmer or more brilliant as the result. So in emanations, we have a universe in which two extremes are brought together by a series of conditions. And in this, the Kabbalah goes into astronomy. And in the ancient system of astronomy, you had a group of three essential factors. You had the highest factor, which was the zodiac. Then you had the orbits of the seven planets, and then you had the Earth with its four elements. The Kabbalah would liken deity to the zodiac as creator. It would liken the Earth to the planet Earth, which in the old system was placed in the middle of the circles. This would be nature. Between these two were the orbits of the seven spirits, or the Elohim, that move upon the face of the deep. And forth from each end, in the middle of the seven planets, was the sun in their system, with the three planets, Saturn, Jupiter, and Mars, above it, and the three lesser lights of the old system, Venus, Mercury, and the moon below, in the form of a ladder extending from the earth to the sky, the ladder of seven rungs, the ladder upon which Jacob saw angels ascending and descending. This placed the sun itself in the midst of the whole system. This was the Pythagorean theory of music, for it was by placing the fret on the string in the relation of the sun in the midst of the string, in the middle part, that produced the interval of the octave.